This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Professor Dennis Dooling. We're talking with him by phone in to New York. Dennis, can you hear me all right?
I can.
Good. We have a good connection. Tell us where you are in New York.
Well, I live about 30 miles north of Buffalo, where the Niagara River empties into Lake Ontario. It's called Youngstown. It's not too far from the Queenston-Lewiston Bridge across Canada, and when I look across the river, I can see Niagara-on-the-Lake, Ontario.
And
does that help?
And you've just recently retired from a nearby college there, Canisius College in Buffalo.
That's correct. It's a Jesuit school.
And how long have you been on the faculty there?
About 30 years.
We're talking with you today about the Gospel of Matthew in the New Testament, in the Bible. Now, the Bible was written over about a thousand-year period. When was Matthew written, do you think? I know it doesn't come with that kind of information as part of the text.
That's correct. Any attempt to date the Gospels is based on some kind of analysis of certain texts within them, since they don't date themselves. It's usually dated around 80 to 90 in the Common Era, which is the term we use for A.D., there are a number of reasons for that. There are some references that seem to point to the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans in 70, and then we have some critical theories about when Mark was written, and if Mark was written first, Matthew was written after Mark, using Mark, then we think that it was also around 80 to 90, since Mark is usually dated around 70. Those are some of the reasons, but it's an academic guessing game, and it's probably pretty accurate. This also fits the socioeconomic and political context of the gospel, since the major enemies of Jesus in the gospel are the Pharisees, and we think that that has been elaborated quite a bit by the writer to suit his own time period. And in this particular time period, the Pharisees are attempting to gain control of the whole Jewish community after the war with Rome. So they're gaining in power, you might say.
So the fact that the Gospel of Matthew has Jesus sort of attacking the Pharisees in various ways would fit with that time.
Exactly. Chapter 23 is the classic passage in which there are seven woes. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, it's a refrain. It's a very, very strong kind of statement, unfortunately been used down through the centuries for Christian anti-Semitism.
We'll get into that topic later in this hour, and we're very fortunate, of course, on Keeping the Faith here on this regional NPR station to be able to spend a whole hour on an important topic with an expert. Let me say just a little bit about our guest, Dennis Dooling, and his last name is spelled D-U-L-I-N-G, is a noted professor of biblical studies. He is the author of the introduction and the notes in the very widely used study Bible put out by HarperCollins of the New Revised Standard Version, which has just gone into a second edition. He's also the author of a widely used textbook on the New Testament as a whole that's went through, how many, four editions, Dennis?
Is
something,
yes.
Something
mm-hmm.
like that. And has been a strong member throughout his career of the Society for Biblical Literature, the main professional group of scholars who deal with biblical material. So we're very pleased that he's willing to give us an hour talking about one of his specialties. He has others, of course, which is the Gospel of Matthew. Now, the Bible is widely owned and perhaps not quite so widely read, but so many people around the world read the Bible, and of course for Christians, the New Testament Gospels are central texts. why is Matthew the first gospel that's in the New Testament? Let's start with some of these the very basic issues.
That's an excellent question. It has to do a little bit with the murky development of collections of manuscripts in the early years of the Christian movement. The four Gospels were connected as a group at one point, and we think Matthew was the first in that collection. Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, was believed to have been written by we usually call him a tax collector, or toll collector is probably a better term, and disciple of Jesus. This is in Matthew 9:9 and 10:3. And he's in the list of disciples and identified there as a toll collector. This particular author, however, is probably an addition to the text in the early second century sometime. All of the four Gospels are not identified by their authors. Those authors are traditional authors. Again, inserted into the manuscripts, we think, in the second century.
Now, let me see if I understand that or clarify it for listeners. You're saying that in the actual text of the gospel itself, it doesn't say, I wrote this and my name is Matthew.
That's right. But you do have, as the manuscripts progress, a distinction made between four gospels. And what's put in there is a superscription, like a title. So you have one according to Matthew, according to Mark, according to Luke, and according to John. You can see that's kind of a formula. And that particular formula, we think, was added to distinguish the Gospels inside a particular collection of manuscripts.
I see. Okay.
Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And so we think that the name Matthew was inserted. It just says according to Matthew in the manuscripts that have survived. Now, we have no manuscripts that don't have that, so this is in part theory, but it's fairly standard theory, since, as you said at the beginning, the authors don't identify themselves. They're anonymous. And if they're wrong, if the identification is wrong, you might say they're pseudonymous, false authors.
Uh-huh.
This was put in for pretty good reason. Name Matthew occurs there, Matthew the toll collector, in the story of the calling of Levi in the Gospel of Mark. The name, we think, has been changed from Levi to Matthew. So that's one possible reason this particular gospel was named according to Matthew. It's a little bit like Alfred Hitchcock in the sense that a name occurs and people would have thought that that was an important name because one of the 12 disciples, and then it would have been put into the manuscript. But there are a lot of other reasons. The name for disciple sounds a good deal like the name Matthew in Greek, and so on. To get back to your original question here, the Gospel of Matthew is put first because it was thought that he was certainly a disciple and tax collector. And especially, I think, because what you have in Matthew are very distinct ideas about the development of the church. In fact, the word ecclesia, church, occurs in the four Gospels, only in the Gospel of Matthew. So you have a lot of church ideas. You have a prominent role for the disciples. They come off a little bit better in this Gospel than they do in the source of Mark. There are a lot of very, very important teachings. Sermon on the Mount, for example, is in Matthew. So that was very important for early moral and ethical instruction. There are just a number of reasons why church members in the second century would have thought that this was a very important gospel. As time develops in the third century as well, and that famous text in Matthew 16, Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, is the old King James translation. And the bishops of Rome then appealed to that particular text to establish their authority over the other bishops around the Mediterranean. So there are a lot of reasons for Matthew being a very important church document It's the first gospel, not only in the collection, but as such, I think.
And there are all those quotations in Matthew from the Hebrew Bible, from the old, what Christians call the Old Testament, so that it kind of makes a tie between the Gospels for Christians in a way the other three Gospels don't.
Well, Matthew has what are called formula quotations, which begin with a formula, something like, this was to fulfill what the prophet wrote, or, you know, they're not all exactly the same, but they're almost like what we would call, I guess, footnotes. They interrupt the story or the section of sayings where they happen to be, and they are an attempt to show that the story, of course, was prophesied, or the sayings were prophesied, and therefore according to the will of God. And so it becomes a very, very authoritative book related to what we would call Jewish tradition. Some of us in the group that I'm in don't use the word Jewish much anymore for a variety of reasons. We could talk about that later if you like, but most of your listeners will understand that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the problem with anti-Semitism in the early Christian documents. That's a very important issue in terms of interfaith relations. Matthew isn't perhaps the worst offender, but let's talk about what is in Matthew which causes that problem.
Well, that's a very excellent question, and a lot of scholars have been interested in it, especially since, of course, the Holocaust during World War II, and a number of books have been written about this, and also what might have brought about the division between Jews and Christians as time went on, beginning in the period about the time of Matthew and going into the second century. The passage I mentioned at the outset, Matthew 23, is a very, very important passage in the gospel to illustrate the antagonism toward Pharisees. The Pharisees were a group, kind of a religious collectivity that existed, especially in the late first century. It's somewhat debated about how early they go back and even whether they existed at the time of Jesus. But certainly very important in the late first century, at the time the gospel was written. And these woe sayings that I mentioned earlier do give you a very strong impression that Jesus was fighting against the Pharisees. Even if that's increased, if you make the gospel later on into a Christian document, a Christian canonical document, rather than a document of its own day in which there is controversy between Jewish people who believe that Jesus was Messiah and Jewish people who do not believe that Jesus was the Messiah. In other words, a kind of a Jewish controversy, then you begin to reread the gospel as an attack on Judaism itself. And so if you look up the word Pharisee in an English language dictionary, usually somewhere down along the line you will see a definition that says hypocrite. That's taken right out of this chapter. So later, when the gospel becomes part of the Christian canon, the original historical, social, economic context for the gospel is somewhat forgotten, and then we read it's an attack on Judaism as such. The stories, of course, of the Passion of Jesus and his death and resurrection reinforce all of that.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Professor Dennis Duling, that's Duling, just recently retired, just this spring, from Canisius College, a Jesuit school in Buffalo, New York, as professor of biblical studies. He is the author of several important articles on the Gospel of Matthew, and indeed has a book coming out on Matthew. Is that correct, or is it out already?
No, it's not out yet. It is a pulling together a number of the articles I've done in the last, oh, I suppose, 15 years on the Gospel of Matthew into a single volume. So it's a collection of essays, you might call it.
And the second edition of the HarperCollins Study Bible, using the New Revised Standard Version translation of the Bible, is used widely, as is Professor Dooling's New Testament introduction. It first came out in 82.
The Study Bible was edited by Wayne Meeks at Yale, and it's put together by a lot of scholars from the Society of Biblical Literature.
Right. And when Meeks talks in his introduction to this, to both editions, he talks about how much misunderstanding there's been about the Bible. How does that carry over into Matthew? What are some of the things that you would most like people to know about the Gospel of Matthew that perhaps ways that it's misused or ways that it's misunderstood?
Well, Steve, I think you put your finger on the probably the major one by asking about anti-Semitism. Understanding the Bible in its original context as a possible inner Jewish conflict, which is quite common today in scholarship, it's a little bit difficult to tell. There's a whole set of literature called the Parting of the Ways. It's a little bit difficult to tell in Matthew just how far the ways have parted. There are these very, very strong anti-Pharisaic statements. But at the same time, as you noted at the beginning, this particular gospel quotes the Old Testament, and there are these formula quotations we mentioned more than any other of the gospels.
So there's a clear love of quality to it. Yes, there's clearly a deep love of Judaism.
Exactly. The old theory about Matthew was it was actually written in Hebrew or Aramaic. Modern scholars don't think that's the case. They don't think it's a translation document. But you can understand how such an opinion might develop. Part of the question from a scholarly point of view is that some of these quotations are not taken from the usual Bible used by early Christians, which would be pretty much equivalent to the Protestant Old Testament, but in Greek form, which is called the Septuagint. Some of these quotations, in these special kinds of quotations, are not Septuagintal. They're not from the Greek version of the Bible in use in among our Christian groups. So that makes you think that here we have somebody who is not only deeply rooted in Judaism, but maybe very linguistically capable of quoting different versions of the ancient texts in different languages, depending on the point he wants to score. Some of these points he can score about Christianity or his particular version of early Christianity can be done better in certain languages than in other languages. So we have a person here who's a very intelligent, a scribal type, a Jewish scribal type, who is deeply rooted in Judaism of the first century. And yet there is this conflict. So you can see why some scholars have come to the conclusion that this is not really a Jewish-Christian conflict, even though it has fed the fires of anti-Semitism for centuries, but maybe, in fact, an inner Jewish conflict, or at least a conflict that occurs at the beginning of the separation of Judaism from Christianity. So that's probably the main problem with the interpretation of Matthew and how things have changed.
Let me invite our listeners to join our discussion with Professor Dennis Dooling from Canisius College in New York. The phone numbers are in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Elsewhere, anywhere the program can be heard, you may call us toll-free, 1-800-333-9455. 1-800-222-9455. And we are eager to have people make comments, raise objections, join the conversation. Dennis, one of the things...
Might I mention just a couple quick points? One, of course, has to do with the fact, if this is not a gospel written by an eyewitness of Jesus' ministry, that is one, a disciple, tax collector, but some unknown figure in the late first century who used sources that are Greek, you get a very different impression of what's going on. You can see the author working a bit with his sources and changing them. Still another way in which things are becoming quite different is an area I'm very much interested in. That's social scientific criticism, it's called. It's an attempt to understand the first century and documents within the first century from the perspective of social sciences. That's a relatively new thing that's been going on, maybe 20, 25 years, and there are several groups interested in that kind of thing, but our particular group tries to use social science theory, for example, ancient agrarian societies, to try to understand the whole religious, economic, political, social context of these documents.
Now, in your introduction in the HarperCollins Study Bible, you mentioned that there's this marvelous vision, and I'm quoting you here, there's this marvelous vision of Jesus as the compassionate, healing Messiah, Son of David, royal Son of God, apocalyptic Son of Man, who is claimed as the fulfillment of the Torah, the Jewish law, and of the prophets, and who calls his followers to spread the good news of the kingdom of heaven to the whole world. You end your introduction to the gospel with that focus on Jesus, and of course, Matthew does have some of these sort of biographical characteristics of it. How does that fit in with your study of social scientific settings?
Do you mean by your question that the gospel sounds biographical?
Well, there seems to be some elements of biography in it. I don't know much about what biographies were like in the first century.
You're asking questions that are often debated. What's the prototype for the type of literature we have in the Gospels? We call them Gospels, right, as though it were a standard kind of literature from the first century, but they are actually, there's a whole literature on the genre of Gospels. It's easier with letters because we have lots of ancient letters to compare with the letters of Paul, but when you get into these particular types of writings, you can ask yourself, are these biographies? Are these something that we've never seen before? Is this a creation of early Christian literature? It's quite debated. I myself think that those people who argue that this is a special kind of biography come close to the mark. But it's nothing quite like the biographies, for example, we know from ancient Greek literature, or something that might come close to biography in Jewish literature. So there are these unique combinations. It is a story. It's a story that has, you might say, beginning, middle, and end. It is a story told about a person, but major things, as you know, are left out and so on. And so it's very difficult to nail it down quite exactly. But I would say it comes closest to an ancient, what's called a bios. That's where we get the term biography, writing about a life. That's the Greek background for the term biography. And they are called a bios or a bios. And those seem to come closest, but we have all these quotations, for example, from the Old Testament. That's very distinctive. And so there are a number of things about this that don't quite fit. It doesn't quite fit the hero model of biography either. You could interpret the Gospel of Mark, for example, as ending in tragedy. Most people don't go quite that far, but and Matthew, the writer of Matthew, doesn't seem to like the Mark and ending very much, and kind of helps us to see some victory at the other end. But the genre question is quite an interesting question. It's not really fully answered, but the biography comes close, the ancient biography. Ancient biographies are, by the way, not like modern biographies in the sense that modern biographers try to be as historically accurate as possible, even though, of course, they're interpretations. Ancient biographies have other kinds of motivations.
Let's talk a little bit about
the genre question.
Yeah, that is. Let's talk a little bit about the source question. You've mentioned Mark, the Gospel of Mark, a much shorter gospel, seemingly being used by Matthew as it does, as it seems to be used by Luke. Mm-hmm. And the sort of scholarly consensus, as I understand it as an outsider, is that it's thought that whoever put Matthew together knew Mark and quoted extensively from it, followed the general outline, but also had other material that at that person's disposal that was special. It might include a source of quotations of Jesus. Talk to us a little bit about that and straighten me out where I'm wrong, please.
Well, I guess scholars don't agree on anything. But you're putting forward what is usually the majority opinion. Some scholars who don't hold that opinion think that the majority is doing the counting and calling itself a majority, perhaps. But I think it's generally accepted that the majority of scholars accept what's called the two-source theory, or sometimes called the four-source theory. That's confusing, perhaps. But the two-source theory is that Mark is the earliest of the first three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and was written probably around the 70s, as I mentioned earlier, and that Matthew and Luke, the other two Gospels, used Mark as a source. There is a problem. Matthew and Luke have a lot of passages that are verbally the same, not only in English, but in the original Greek. The classical theory from antiquity was that Matthew was, in fact, not only the first gospel in the canon and important as the first gospel, but it was the first gospel written. That was the old theory. And so you could easily explain the places in Matthew and Luke that aren't in Mark by saying that Luke simply copied some of them from the Gospel of Matthew because it was first. Modern critics, in putting Mark first, then have to explain those passages in Matthew and Luke, the other two Gospels, that are verbally the same, in a different way, especially if they don't think that the writer of Luke knew the Gospel of Matthew. So they posit a lost source, essentially, and most people have heard about this lost source. It goes by the name Q, which one theory is that that's a German name that's translated into English from Quelle, which is the German word for source, simple word for source. The British once disputed that, which is an interesting side story, but most people will use that as an explanation. So that this particular source was first developed by comparing Matthew and Luke and looking at those passages they share in common that are not in Mark, and then assembling them, you might say. And this was an early part of the 19th century when this theory develops. And it turns out that almost all of these passages are sayings of Jesus. So this source sometimes goes by the words sayings source. Another interesting little sidelight of this is that at the time, no exact sayings source like this was known to exist. And so it was pretty much of a theory in the air. However, in the 20th century, scholars began to reflect a lot about the Gospel of Thomas, which was discovered at Nag Hammadi in Egypt, a place in Egypt, in around 1947, 48, with the Nag Hammadi texts, and it's 114 sayings of Jesus.
Dennis, I'm going to have to interrupt there because we do have an important weather announcement we need to make.
Thank you.
A severe thunderstorm watch is in effect until 8 p.m. this evening for the following counties in the WILL severe weather coverage area: Champaign, Piatt, DeWitt, Macon, Shelby, Moultrie, Crawford, Edgar, Clark, Cumberland, Vermilion, Coles, and Douglas. Repeating, a severe thunderstorm watch in effect until 8 p.m. this evening. Stay tuned to WILL for the latest weather information.
We returned our interview with Professor Dennis Dooling. We're talking about the Gospel of Matthew in the Bible, the Christian New Testament, and he was just telling us about the discovery in 1947 of the Gospel of Thomas, which is a source of a collection of the sayings of Jesus.
Yes, so now there was a parallel. That is, there was an actual document that collected sayings that at least was analogous to what scholars had called Q, 100 years or so earlier. And so that tended to reinforce the possibility, at least, that the Q hypothesis as a source for Matthew and Luke was legitimate. There are major Q scholars. John Kloppenburg at the University of Toronto, for example, is a very well-known Q scholar. They spend most of their life, although John is into other things too, but spend most of their life just trying to assemble, interpret, theorize about this lost gospel, which we think Matthew and Luke used. So there are two sources for Matthew, Mark and Q. And then there are special materials in the gospel that are in no known source, and you mentioned the possibility of a lost collection of prophecy fulfillment texts that might have been a source for these formula quotations we talked about, where Matthew quotes the Old Testament and says that the stories and the sayings fulfill the Old Testament. That's been a well-worked-over hypothesis. It's, there are a number of books about it. It's a theory based upon notice of such collections in the literature of early Christianity. And it's a plausible hypothesis, I think, and a number of major scholars have tried to isolate what was in the source and so forth. There might have been miracle collection sources, parables. Mark, the Gospel of Mark, has four parables in chapter 4 that are kind of organized around the theme of sowing and seed. Matthew expands that into seven parables in Matthew 13. These are all plausible hypotheses that have to do with other kinds of sources behind the documents that are written. And then behind all of these written sources, of course, there is the long-standing theory that there was oral tradition. And in some cases, you may get mixtures of oral traditions and written sources. It's a complicated process.
How early are the written sources that we have for Matthew?
Well, that's all theory. People tried to suggest that Q, this hypothetical sayings source, probably was written around 50 or 60, maybe in Galilee. That's the kind of customary theory about Q. But that's a hypothesis based upon, the probability that the material in there is in its form that we have it now, very apocalyptic. Kloppenburg one time argued that perhaps some of the apocalyptic materials, that is, materials about the end of the world, judgment and so forth, were superimposed upon an earlier kind of literature, which we call, or earlier kind of sayings, which we call wisdom material, which are less about the end of the world, more about practical everyday life.
And how early are the actual manuscripts or fragments of manuscripts of the Gospel of Matthew?
Well, some of the earliest manuscripts of the New Testament don't have particular passages from Matthew, but our earliest fragments are papyrus fragments from the second century. The earliest fragment of all of the New Testament is a little fragment of the Gospel of John. It's very famous, called P52, Papyrus 52. usually dated by experts in scripts around 125, 130, some dated a little later. But that's a very small one little piece of scrap. It's written on both sides. Most of our earliest papyri fragments come from the later 2nd, 3rd century on. And then we begin to get manuscripts written on leather or vellum.
Let's
so
move.
Our manuscript history is a kind of a different academic enterprise in certain respects. There are specialists in the area of manuscripts, ancient manuscripts.
Let's move to how the Gospel of Matthew is used. And this next question, Professor Dealing, maybe unfair for a biblical scholar, but why do conservative Christians seem to quote most from the Gospel of John and liberal Christians quote most from the Gospel of Matthew, particularly, say, Matthew 25?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure that's true, but I'll take my stab at it. It could be because Matthew 25 has a very important parable of the Last Judgment. And in that particular parable, we have acts of mercy, which became very important for Roman Catholic doctrine. Okay? So they often refer to these in the connection with the ethical teaching of Jesus. I just pulled out my Bible here. This is I call it the Last Judgment, but this is when all the nations are gathered before the Son of Man and the angels, and he separates people as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats, putting the sheep at the right hand, the goats at the left. The right hand is always better than the left in the ancient Near East and in the modern period, for that matter. The right hand is for eating, the left hand is for other things. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, "Come that you are blessed by my Father, and here the king prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you walked to me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me." And the righteous will answer him, "Lord, didn't we do all that?" And he says, "Truly I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these who are members of my family," that's the New Revised Standard Version translation, "you did it to me." So it's a social message, right? And at least if you wanted to find a program to develop for Jesus' ethical and moral teaching, you certainly would find a lot in Matthew in a passage like that, as well, of course, as the Sermon on the Mount.
Let's do talk about the Sermon on the Mount. That's distinctive to Matthew. It's not found in that form in the other Gospels in the Christian New Testament. Talk to us a little bit about the Sermon on the Mount. It's been so important for Christians for these last 2,000 years or so.
Well, the Sermon on the Mount, you know, there's an interesting source question, by the way. A very famous scholar at the University of Chicago, Hans-Dieter Betz, who I think he's in partial retirement now, wrote a very, very, very thick book on the Sermon on the Mount and saw some source material in there for a collection. I came from a more redaction-oriented position, which means that I tend to think that the author of Matthew used sources such as Q and composed the Sermon on the Mount. There are a lot of interesting possibilities for that. Jesus goes up on the mountain for the Sermon on the Mount, of course. There's a whole mountain theme in the Gospel of Matthew. The story ends on a mountain, an unknown mountain in Galilee. There's the Mount of Transfiguration, and so on. So there's a notion of revelation here associated with the mountain. And he sits down to teach, like we think later rabbinic teachers sat to teach. And then he gives all the Beatitudes and a lot of moral teaching. These are some of the key passages known to Christians. Let me give you an example about where we think that maybe Q comes into the picture, okay?
Sure.
Most people who learn any scripture by heart anymore, which is not as common as it used to be, know the Beatitudes. And the first one in Matthew 5:3 says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." That's the familiar one. The Lucan version of that, see, that's not in Mark. It's in Luke. So it raises the question about this source, this law source, is blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God.
So it does not have the addition in spirit.
That's correct.
Yeah.
It has long been thought by people who think that Matthew modified his sources for his own time period, that he added in spirit. It's not, total agreement on that, but certainly that's been a common viewpoint. The curious thing is that theory that Matthew added in spirit seems to be supported by the Gospel of Thomas, this newly discovered gospel, which has all the sayings in saying 54, seems to support the Lucan version, which would indicate that probably, this is a hypothesis, probably the earliest version just simply had poor, and that Matthew added spirit. So that Matthew's gospel appears to look a little less concerned about, in this particular instance at least, the actual poor, and is a little bit more interested in what we might call religious teaching about the poor in spirit. There are other examples of that sort of thing, but Matthew seems to be using, in this case, the Q source and modifying it. And we see him doing that with Mark a lot. The Sermon on the Mount, then, has a lot of Q material in it, but it also has a special material in it that we don't track. So in some cases, some scholars would think that Matthew has created it. You might theorize that some of it comes from another law source that we don't have. A classic example is Sermon on the Mount is chapters 5 through 7. A classic example would be near the beginning, after the Beatitudes and a couple of short sayings, Jesus' words on the law. Those are not in anybody's gospel, and they sound so Matthean that a scholar by the name of John Meyer wrote his dissertation just on this little passage once. He's since become a very famous Jesus scholar at the University of Notre Dame. He wrote just on this passage. And it says, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill. Truly I tell you, until heaven and earth pass away, not one letter, not one stroke of a letter will pass from the law until all is accomplished," and so on. So it sounds like that Jesus, therefore, is very interested in having everyone keep the letter of the law. Now, that sounds very conservative. In fact, these expressions may refer to little flourishes. When you write Hebrew letters, you make little flourishes, little tails on the letters. It's maybe referring to those. And the smallest letter of the Hebrew language, a yod, that's possible. It seems like that's what it's referring to. So it's a very strong passage about fulfilling the law. And then in the next few sections of the gospel, Jesus turns right around and he seems to be reinterpreting the law. These are called the antitheses. For example, let's take the one on adultery. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Now, would you say that teaching is directed to men or women? I'm bringing in social themes here. Well, it's obviously directed towards men. Looks at a woman with lust in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out, throw it away. People know these things. It's better for you to lose one of your members than your whole body, be thrown into hell. If your right eye causes you to sin, right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one of your members than for the whole body to go into hell. Now, we have no parallel for that, but it's one of these six contrasts between what was taught and what the new teaching is.
And when you say we have no parallel for that, you're saying in the other Gospels.
In the other Gospels.
Yes.
So this is special to Matthew.
Right.
It has to do with Old Testament law. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. Well, everybody knows that's from the commandments, the Ten Commandments. And then we have, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery. So you have a teaching that, in this particular instance, sounds even sharper or stronger or intensified than the original commandment. It tries to go to the heart of the motivation of the ancient teaching about not committing adultery.
Let me repeat our phone numbers again. If you have a question for our guest today, Professor Dennis Dooling of Canisius College in New York, biblical scholar talking about the Gospel of Matthew. Call us, 333-9455 is the local number in the Champaign-Urbana area. If it's a long-distance call, do call us at 1-800-222-9455. Dennis Dooling, his PhD was from University of Chicago. Where was your undergraduate study, Dennis?
My undergraduate study at the College of Worcester in Ohio, which is a Presbyterian school.
And you've been
to seminary in Chicago at McCormick Theological Seminary.
And you've been at the Jesuit College of Canisius for 30 years. We have our lines all lit up. Let's give line number one a chance. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Yes, I was interested in the antitheses that you just quoted.
Mm-hmm.
You think Matthew was trying to institute an even more legalistic type religion, or is he parroting and making fun of the Pharisees' attempts to do so?
Well, in some respects, I think probably the former. If you look at that passage, I said John Meyer wrote his dissertation on, that's in Matthew 5:17-20. You'll see once again that you have to follow the letter of the law, and that if you go on, I didn't finish the passage, but if you go on, it talks about unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, that's combative. That's polemic. And the opponents, again, are, here the expression is scribes and Pharisees. I focused on the Pharisees. I think in Matthew's gospel there are good scribes and bad scribes. The bad scribes tend to be linked with groups that Jesus opposed. But you can see that there's a we and a they here, and we have to do it this way, and they do it that way, and theirs is not good enough. Their righteousness has to do with fulfilling God's will according to Scripture. And so you have here in this particular saying, your morality, you might say, has to be better than their morality. And you can see that the polemic we talked about at the beginning seems to be here. Is that what you had in mind?
We've lost that caller, but if he wants to follow up, he can sure call back. Let's go to another line. We have caller number four. Line number four. Yes, you're on the air.
A very interesting program. You made a comment that struck me as very interesting when you said that conservatives like to quote John and liberals like to quote Matthew. Let me switch that around a little bit. many evangelicals, people who claim to take the Bible seriously, seem to find ways around not applying the Sermon on the Mount in terms of ethics. Maybe the extreme end seem to postpone the application of the Sermon on the Mount to this end, or don't emphasize it too much. Could you come up? Would you have any reasons why that is so?
Well, I suppose the most obvious thing is that this is a very highly law-oriented book in a very conservative, law-oriented environment where the opponents are also people, the Pharisees, are people who interpret the law. And we live in a secular culture. So, I mean, you could probably debate, you know, what part of our culture is secular, what part of it's not, and so forth and so on. But certainly, in general, most of the Euro-American culture is certainly more secular than the ancient world of the Bible. I would suggest probably the ancient world of the Bible is much more like Middle Eastern culture today in some respects, even though you might well argue that there are a lot of variety there, too. But in any case, I would say that the Sermon on the Mount is pretty stringent, and the model of perfection is held up as certainly an ideal, and the theologians, whether they're biblical scholars as such or not, actually debate quite a bit whether or not the Sermon on the Mount is meant to be an ethical ideal, somewhat almost impossible to totally achieve, at least in this life.
I realize it, but I think some Christians at least make attempts to apply it. It seems like so much of the conservative voice seems to sort of say, well, it was just for that time and not meant for people today. But anyway, thank you.
Appreciate the call. Thank you very much. We have another caller waiting on line number two. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith, line two.
I think he thought I didn't answer his question, but
we'll
go on there. And he's probably right. A lot of people don't accept the literalness of Sermon on the Mount today.
All right. And line number two.
Is that for me?
Yes.
Okay. I call into this program lots of times. My question is, I don't know. It seems to me the current philosophy is very different from ancient times. And so I wonder if the speaker could address that. Thank you.
All right. She's asking about the differences between ancient times and today. Does that make the gospel irrelevant?
Well, she's put her finger right on a key question. You know, I mentioned earlier that I'm in a group that's very interested in the social sciences and the Bible. And there are, the historians knew this all along, that Bible is from a different world. Its world, in some respects, is more like the ancient East that we have a good deal of difficulty understanding today in the West to begin with. And if you add the difference in culture and the difference in time, the problem of applying the Bible in today's, let's say, churches, or in this case, New Testament wouldn't be synagogues, but let's just stick with churches, is certainly raised, and she's highlighted that particular question. I would say, I mean, people have different responses to this kind of question, but I would say that if you don't interpret the Bible, you're in danger of making it somewhat static and lost somehow in the past. Even the Bible itself, just like we saw Matthew reinterpreting Mark, the Bible is constantly in a process of reinterpretation and updating itself. So there is a kind of premise here that you could develop theologically that we have to constantly reinterpret the Bible to make it make sense. It's a very difficult task. We have difficulty understanding the past. We have difficulty understanding other cultures and the way people think. And one of the social scientific premises here is that we can learn about this by trying to understand the way anthropologists and sociologists understand other peoples. But it's not easy, it is interesting to me that a lot of the priests and ministers, and I would assume rabbis too, are using social scientific methods to try to better understand this different culture. to retain whatever core of meaning they can find theologically for themselves and their communities.
We're down to our last 2 minutes. Let's see if we can get a 30-second question from line one and a 30-second answer. Yes, you're on the air. Line one.
You may have touched upon this earlier, but I wondered if you would be able to or care to comment on assumptions as to the connection between Paul's activity and the writing of the Gospels.
Paul's activity in the Gospels?
Yes, the Apostle Paul.
Ah, that's a good one, too. David Sim has written a whole book extended in other books in which he sees the Gospel of Matthew as a kind of program against Paul, because Paul sees the crucifixion and death of Jesus as a theological premise for going beyond the law. And Matthew seems to be affirming, as we said before, the traditional legal principles of the Torah, even though he presents Jesus as going beyond them and interpreting them. So is the Gospel of Matthew anti-Pauline? That's a good question, and I haven't gone quite as far as David Sim in that thesis, but he is a very fine scholar, and he's made a good case that that's exactly what's going on in Matthew. So we have an inner Christian. Well, it depends on where you think Matthew's Christian again, but we have certainly what developed as Christian literature a kind of tension between freedom from the law and a book that strongly emphasizes law and ethics.
I'd like to thank our callers for their very good comments and questions, and of course our guest, Professor Dennis Dooling, recently retired just this May from Canisius College, Department of Biblical Studies. Dennis Dooling is the author of The New Testament, An Introduction, The New Testament History, Literature, and Social Context, in its fourth edition, a textbook on the study of the New Testament, as well as books on Matthew, and one that will be coming out very shortly on Matthew. He's also wrote the introduction and notes for the HarperCollins Study Bible, whose second edition has just come out this last year. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Next week, I'll be talking with Reverend Peter Dick, the Protestant chaplain at the Provena Covenant Hospital, about life as a hospital chaplain. The following week, on August 3rd, our guest here on Keeping the Faith will be Mark Johnson, who is the executive director for the Fellowship of Reconciliation for this country. Other guests coming up in the future, we have some Muslim guests who will be on the program and Jewish guests. And again, thanks for our callers and our guests today. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.